You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello and welcome to Verge ESP, a podcast about art and science on The Verge. My name is Emily Yoshida. I am the entertainment editor at The Verge.
I'm Liz Lopato. I'm the science editor at The Verge.
And first, we want to note there's an important announcement at the end of this podcast, but that's like a little bit of foreshadowing. So you can either stay through this journey with us or you can fast forward to the end if you love spoilers. Pick your own adventure. It's not a linear medium. We should also contextualize that we are recording this podcast while virtually the entire rest of the Verge staff is watching the Apple event, where I believe they just announced the end of headphones.
Yeah, they're no longer using a headphone jack, which is being presented by Phil Schiller as courageous, and which I believe we are on the record as calling user hostile and stupid.
And money grubbing, and what is that? Isn't that, is there a word that that means vertical integration, but like in a bad way?
That's a good question. I am just pissed about my headphones. Like, cool. So now not only are the headphones that I have obsolete, unless I want to buy a dongle. Ooh, I can see myself
losing
it
already.
I love
buying a good dongle.
Yeah. Who doesn't love a dongle here?
I mean, I feel pretty good about the fact that I tend to take good care of my phones. I lost my last phone. That's the first time I've done that in years. So I like my current phone. I have a 6S. It's great. No real reason for me to switch anytime soon. So I'm just going to ride this one as long as I can. I'm going to have to seriously rethink my Apple customer status.
Well, so what's happening for me is that I have an iPhone 5 that is in the process of giving up the ghost, and I have been limping along with it for the last 2 months, waiting for the announcement, because I knew I wasn't going to buy the new phone with no headphone jack. But if experience serves, after this event, the old phones drop in price.
Oh, yeah, get on that 6 train.
I'm like thinking the SE might be the way that I go.
Yeah.
Because it's the same size as the 5, which is a great size. It's small enough for my hands. And it's got this amazing thing in it where I can just plug in headphones that I use on a variety of other devices.
Yeah, and you can buy those headphones at virtually any retailer. You can buy a pair of headphones at like a bodega if you want.
Right. And it'll cost you like 10
yeah.
bucks. So that's my move.
Well, we're here for all sorts of consumer tips and life hacks. I spent the weekend at IKEA really trying to hack my way around their already discounted furniture and make the most of my dollar. So, yeah, this is an economics podcast now. So, Liz, I got into a kind of lengthy and interesting discussion with some of our fellow Verge staffers this week. We had all seen the new horror film, Don't Breathe, which I had been really looking forward to just from the trailers and what I'd heard about it. For those who don't know, Don't Breathe is a horror film about, I guess it's a horror. Yeah, it's a horror film. It's pretty gross. A group of teens or young adults who are burglars. They burgle houses in Detroit, and they their latest target is a veteran who's received a settlement for a car crash that killed his daughter. And apparently he keeps the settlement in cash in a safe in his house, so they have to go and burgle it.
That's fair. I mean, that's what I do with all my money.
Right. Anytime you settle out of court, you have your special safe for legal fees. So they go and they realize that this guy's blind, their target, but he's also apparently a super fighter. And they need to, once they get into the house, he discovers them there and starts stalking and killing them off one by one. So it's a bunch of teens versus a blind guy. And I thought it was like a really great idea for a horror film. And for the most part, I enjoyed the film. It's like it's my favorite kind of August movie. This was a couple weeks ago that I saw it. Now I think I saw it on opening weekend. And it's like, I feel like the quintessential August movie for me in the last few years was that movie Premium Rush with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Like something where it's just like a nice, fun little concept and it keeps you entertained for an hour and a half and you're out. I like that kind of movie a lot. And those
It's the air conditioning movie,
oh,
right?
Totally.
Where you go to the movie
yeah.
theater because what you want is the air conditioning
yeah.
and you just want something pleasant while you enjoy the air conditioning before you get spat out into New York City, which is like humid to the point of where and hot to the point of where you just feel like you're in someone's mouth
yes.
all the time.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, that's a perfect way to describe it. You feel like you're inside of another body, like you're a baby, like in a you're a fetus in the womb of New York City.
Woo.
Okay, but so I was with this movie almost all the way to the end, and then it pulls out a really really gross move that. Usually I'm down for. I like gross stuff in movies. This was just so out of left field gross and, you know, sexual assault-y in a way that the film had not been up to that point, that it felt very much just like, it felt almost like an afterthought, like the whole film could have gone through without it happening. I don't want to spoil it too much, but our main protagonist, as they tend to be in horror films, is the only female in the group, and she kind of is in a final confrontation with this guy and something super rapey happens. I'll
oh,
just
good.
Say that. But in like a really weird, shocking, genuinely shocking way. And I don't say that as a compliment. Like it's just like it was disruptively shocking. And it really had me thinking about how I had identified with that female character up till then, who's presented as pretty resourceful. And, you know, she's like, morally corrupt in an interesting way, obviously, because she's a burglar, but she also like wants to get away from her bad family and blah blah blah. Like, you know, she's given, I think, more depth than a comparable character of her age would have been given in a horror film maybe 15 or 20 years ago. And I was just thinking, like, how, you know, horror films often go into that kind of rapey territory. It feels even more jarring though now that the heroines of horror films have gotten so much better and come to represent something so much different. I guess they could still be called the final girl, but it feels like a different kind of character altogether.
Maybe for those who are not familiar, we should discuss what the final girl is.
Yes.
Which is a recurring trope in horror movies. And it's pretty common. Even I know about it, even though I mostly don't watch horror movies because I find them too scary. That's my life.
I don't watch horror movies because I find them too rapey. that's not true. I don't know why. I don't know. I find most horror movies pretty boring. I hate to sound like that person, but I just do.
But the whole thing is that there's usually a setup and there are like a set number of characters. And I think Scream adheres to this. And
oh, yeah.
I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Oh, yeah. Those are like the most formulaic of the recent franchises for sure.
And so you have a bunch of characters, and there's always like the slutty girl who gets murdered first, and you know that she's slutty because she is depicted engaging in sexual activity and enjoying it.
Sometimes with the black guy, who's usually the next one to go.
Yeah,
it's true. It happens in I think that's in House of Wax, the one with Paris Hilton in it, which I totally saw just because Paris Hilton was in it, and I was just very morbidly curious.
That was Rob Zombie, right?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think it was a rando, yeah.
And so anyway, she the girl who enjoys sex dies first, and then there's sort of a varying order of deaths of the remaining men, and then there's one woman who survives.
She's the virtuous one, too.
Yeah, she's virginal.
There are two women,
and, like,
yeah.
you know... good,
but she has to find her inner strength so that she can defeat the the final boss.
That's right. And it's just, it's sort of an established thing at this point, because there has in fact been, I think, scholarship on it now. Like, it's not just limited to the realm of criticism. Like, people are writing, you know, dissertations on the final girl.
Totally, yeah.
And you see it in a lot of these movies, particularly the more formulaic ones. But it sounds like this is an interesting twist on this trope of, you know, the pure heroine managing to avoid being eaten by monsters, which is a trope, by the way, that you also see in Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah, no, it goes back that far. Like, she's the ultimate final girl. So the main character, whose name is Rocky, she's played by Jane Levy, who was on the sitcom Suburgatory. Do you remember this sitcom called Suburgatory?
No.
It ran for, it was like weird. It was like when I was at the height of TV blogging, so of course I knew about it. Anyway, she's good. She's like, I mean, to her credit, she's the poor man's Emma Stone. Like, we don't need to beat around the bush. She is the poor man's Emma Stone. But she's great. And basically the film is sort of moved along by this sort of moral question at the center of it, which is like, should we be robbing this guy who's blind if it means that we can get away from whatever fill in the blank troubling scenario that we are stuck in here in, like, the decrepit remains of Detroit. Detroit is like a very, I think it plays a pretty big visual role in the film. There's a good essay on RogerEbert.com about that, about Detroit in this film and in It Follows and Only Lovers Left Alive, which is the Jim Jarmusch vampire movie, which I love. But she, so there's as it kind of progresses, there's always these moments where it's like, do you want to opt out now? Like, do you want to just cut our losses and get out? Or do you want to, like, really either make sure we leave with the money or make sure we kill this guy? Either one. And it's always like, she's always in on the doubling downside. Like, she's never cutting her losses. And you're like, oh, why are you doing this? Like, but it's not in like, oh, dumb girl keeps walking into danger. It's like, she's just stubborn and really wants money, which is like, okay, sure. That's more interesting to me than just a victim, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, she is in some ways willing this to happen because she won't just walk away. It's like the person who, like, is at the casino table and they've won back everything they've lost. And they're like, you know what?
Yeah.
I'm feeling lucky.
Let's just do it again. Yeah. So I mean, I kind of like that dynamic. And there are lots of moments, there are lots of little turning points after, you know, another crazy shootout or, you know, near death or bludgeoning or whatever, where it's like, you know, everybody's catching their breath and you kind of like have this go left or go right moment. And I like that. I think the thing for me is that she's never sexualized in the whole thing, which, like, to the film's credit. And then suddenly at the end, that's the thing that gets her into trouble. And it's like, this has not been presented as a factor in what motivates her character. Like, she has a boyfriend in it, but, like, he's not really that much of a issue in the film. The things that she wants are completely separate from her relationship with this guy. And I don't know. It seemed like something taken from an older kind of horror film that just didn't agree with this. And it also made me think, and if you've seen the film, you know, of course, what I'm talking about. It made me think of 10 Cloverfield Lane. Did you see that?
I did not know.
Liz? Which is, I mean, I loved 10 Cloverfield Lane. I thought it was really good. It also involves a somewhat vaguely rapey scenario, but it's very, very vague in 10 Cloverfield Lane in a way that I kind of respect. And it's sort of, I feel like that film kind of uses it. It turns that kind of whole expected dynamic of, like, a girl's in trouble and there's, like, a imposing male figure that, like, is her adversary. And of course it's going to get rapey at some point or another. It kind of takes that expectation and turns it on its head. I'm trying really hard not to give spoilers for these, especially for 10 Cloverfield Lane, because I think that ends in a really, really good way. Like, I think it actually is cognizant of the fact that that's the direction these stories tend to go and turns that expectation over and, like, iterates upon it. I think Tasha wrote a very interesting piece back when the film was in theaters, and you can look it up on The Verge. Tasha Robinson wrote just about how the film actually is a metaphor for getting out of an abusive situation, which is cool. like, I think it works really well if seen through that. I mean, it works well regardless, but it works well when seen through that lens as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think we've sort of hit the point of Final Girl where the filmmakers know that we know. You know what I mean? And,
right,
and so,
yeah.
Like, for instance, The Cabin in the Woods, I'm just going to spoil it because I don't care.
It's okay. I haven't seen it, but, like, I at this point haven't seen it, and I probably never will if it's been
well,
this long.
Well, I sincerely enjoyed it. It's like a meta horror film. And for me, like, the real creeping awfulness of it is kind of the setup. So, like, you start with, like, these kids are in a cabin in the woods and these bad, mysterious things start happening and they start dying off in the expected order. And then you get these flashes to, like, a control center where people are, like, drinking their coffee and hanging out. And as the movie progresses, these two sort of separate lines come together and you realize that the people in the control center are engaging in some kind of global ritual involving teenagers that is required in order to keep the world going. And there is the reason that horror films proceed in the same way and in the way you expect is because that's required by the ritual. And
wow.
This is the story of that ritual breaking down. And
yeah,
at the very end of the movie, our final girl is, there's a male protagonist who has survived as well, along with our final girl. And she has a choice that is presented to her. And the choice is if she kills him, the world continues. If she does not, the world ends. So it's either the final girl or oblivion.
Right.
And
yeah.
I mean, that is a special level of horror that I particularly enjoyed that is more about, like, how evil human beings are and less about, like, boo, gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that I've enjoyed about these films lately. I was also talking about The Witch, which I think is kind of similar. I mean, you wouldn't, like, it's... So the ritual has something to do specifically with the life force of teenagers? Is that, like,
yeah,
the
it's
idea?
Like some kind of, like, pagan keeping out the demons by making the correct ritual sacrifices.
Yeah, totally. I mean, so The Witch, which is another fantastic film from this year, came out earlier in the year. I think this year was oddly stacked in the first half for me. I loved a bunch of films between January and May, I would say. But that film is, for me, very much about this idea of a teenage girl being, like, the most threatening source of evil and chaos in the world, like a thing that every single member of society fears. I mean, The Witch mostly takes place in a single house in the woods with a Puritan family. It takes place in Puritan times. But the protagonist is a teenage girl. Every member of her family has some reason to kind of hate her or use her as a scapegoat or, you know, just pile shit upon her. And there's, you know, these supernatural occurrences going on. And one of their kids goes missing. And two of their kids go missing. And it all gets blamed on this girl. You know, it's also very tied to the idea of the witch trials and that would be like a young woman would be who Satan would prey upon because they were easy to turn towards the darkness.
Mm.
Which I will say, not inaccurate, but totally fine. nothing wrong with Satan. But I think that there's something about that film that, and I'll spoil the ending of that film because I don't think it takes away from the enjoyment of it. She does eventually, the witches are real in The Witch. And at the end, Thomason, the main character, she goes and joins them. And it's like, why wouldn't you? The witches are having fun and they're not bound by Puritanism and they get to, like, you know, like, be free with their womanhood.
Well, and also she's already getting blamed for everything. Like, she has no good reason to support the system that she has been born into because she has been just repeatedly beaten by it, it sounds like.
Yeah. And I think the ending, you know, it could be read as like, oh, Satan wins in the end. But it also feels like she wins because she gets to kind of, I wrote in this thing that will be going up tomorrow, she gets to kind of time travel out of Puritan times by, like, joining these supernaturally powerful ladies, which is, it's an interesting way to reframe that kind of thing. Any other interesting final girls you've seen lately?
Well, I mean, the one that I think of a lot, of course, is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, who was, you know, a very early part of this trend Like, that was, like, literally what Joss Whedon was doing with the first movie and then with the series, right? Is that she's the slutty girl that you expect to die first.
Yeah.
And she doesn't. She's the final girl.
Yeah. I mean, I think it also helps to have... There's something about the performance that's so key. Like... And that's where I get a little bit at a loss for words because I'm bad at talking about acting in films. But I know, you know when an actor has been directed to be somebody that we are watching events through versus somebody who we are watching events happen to. And I feel like the way that Sarah Michelle Gellar is in that show is very much a person that we are supposed to attach to and see the world through her eyes versus like a victim or just like she could still be a vampire slayer and kill a lot of vampires, but be there purely to be observed. And I feel like it's a little that character, the idea of that character, the way that it's presented, the way the character is presented, it brings in the viewer a lot more, which is like also how you make a fandom happen. Well, I continue to be completely ambivalent on the horror genre aside from the Purge movies. But I'm, you know, the more stuff that comes out like this that, I mean, like ending aside, Don't Breathe is a very interesting horror film. I enjoyed it. The ending a little bit ruins it for me. It makes it so I can't like recommend it glowingly, but I still think that the stuff going on in it is... It felt new to me, so I will continue to check out horror films that feel like they might not be total garbage. That's my promise.
Well, you know, what you're saying about endings is really interesting. I see crashes a lot on endings. I feel like takeoffs and landings are the hardest places for stories. You know, once you're cruising at 10,000 feet or whatever your altitude is, like, it's pretty smooth, but getting up there and getting down there can be really tricky. And so...
Go see Sully in theaters this weekend.
So, you know, I think it might be worth, after the break, thinking a little bit about how narratives work and what we look for in endings. Closing time. So it turns out there's a psychology of narratives. Shocker, I know. For instance, I think maybe the best place to start is with Daniel Kahneman, who you may or may not know. There was a book that's very accessible called Thinking Fast and Slow. He's a psychologist. I believe he's won a Nobel in economics. But he thinks about the ways in which we are predictably irrational, because we are often irrational in the exact same ways. And so what he discusses are sort of the ways that we think without really knowing that we think that way. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that he talks about is the way that working memory functions, which, you know, how our memories are captured, basically, and then how we accrue meaning with those experiences. And so, you know, usually what happens with a working memory is it's like assembled someplace, I don't know, the prefrontal lobe, and the brain like removes information that's irrelevant. So like, for instance, if you have a hard time remembering character names for a story, but you remember this story really well, it's because your brain decided the character names were not that important. This is a problem with my brain.
That tends to be the case, honestly.
And so in this process, the short-term memory gets converted into a long-term memory. And so there's sort of these modes in which you have memories, and he calls them the experiencing self and the remembering self. The experiencing self, I'm quoting here, is the one that answers the question, does it hurt now? And the remembering self is the one that answers the question, how was it on the whole? What was it like? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, in some sense, we construct narratives. We've talked about this, like our entire understanding of our lives really is a kind of a narrative. And it turns out people judge their experiences based on the most intense moment of the experience rather than like a sort of a flat average. And
right,
the end is part of what helps shape that as well. The duration doesn't really matter that much. So it's like the thing that you love the most and also how it ended that really matter when we're remembering things, reflecting on things, and thinking about how this works.
So for instance, when I was talking about Don't Breathe, which, you know, you heard my tone of voice where I'm like, it's pretty good. Like, you know, it goes up by like 3 octaves. I'm like, yeah, it's pretty Jerry Seinfeld voice. Pretty good movie. But man, that ending sure was a bummer. That's clearly the thing that has stuck in my mind the most. And so that's why, in the end, like, I feel like I can't really recommend it just because of that one peak. The moment in the movie where my brain was sending me the most high alert signals was the ending, which I did not like.
And like, it's a really common thing where you'll have these very popular, most often TV shows, where people just hate the endings. And the one that's most obvious to me is Seinfeld, right? Which is like this.
Or Lost, which I didn't see. I didn't. I continue to be a Lost.
Yeah, that's Lost two of us. but like Seinfeld, for instance, you know, you have this like kind of show about nothing. And then you've like come to really like these characters and maybe even like darkly identify with them sometimes. The final ending is like a total.
It's like a judgment. It's a moral judgment.
I mean, they're literally
on them in a way that's
they're literally
not
put on trial.
Yeah.
And like found to be terrible.
Yeah.
And like all of the people from their past come and testify against them. And like rightly, like they've done all of the terrible things they're accused of.
Right.
And then they go to jail. And that is the end of Seinfeld.
I mean, when you read a description of the finale of Seinfeld, it does sound like a goof. It sounds like something that somebody came up with, like at a bar or something. Like, what if they all went to jail?
Well, that's how we'll end it.
Yeah, I mean, I think in practice it feels a little. I kind of don't mind it that much because I guess because of that level of audacity of like, well, how else are you going to end the show? Like, it's got to, not that you need to find meaning for the, you know, whatever, 6 or 7 seasons that have preceded it. How many seasons?
Oh, I don't even know. But
I think it was a lot. But like, it not that you need to contextualize to be like, okay, so here's what it all meant, you guys. But I think there's no way to put a button on a show that is about nothing without going into the realm of the absurd, which I feel like
yeah,
is
that's
what
exactly
they
what they did. But you know, there is like kind of this need for cognitive closure, and this is like another social psychology thing where we want to have like firm answers. We don't really want ambiguity. And so, you know, when you think about these things, what you're thinking about is how to create a closure, how to design closure, because it is psychologically satisfying. And like one of the problems that I think American TV shows have that I don't see as often with other kinds of TV shows is that because they've been running so long, there's no way to design a satisfying ending. Right? Like after like 8 seasons or 10 seasons or whatever, there's just an ending. And it, you know, it's hard to have it feel earned by every single season because when they were writing the first season, they didn't realize it was going to go on for 10 seasons. And so there isn't stuff that's starting at the very beginning that you then get closure with at the end.
I kind of want to know what endings of TV shows, which finales you remember most. I'm not saying the ones that are the best, but the ones that you actually remember. Because now that you're saying this, I'm realizing I don't remember what happened at the end of Friends. And I don't even remember what happened at the end of Seinfeld. Or not Seinfeld, at Frasier, which is crazy. I should know what happens at the end of Frasier. But
for me, the ones that I remember best are Roseanne, Buffy, mm-hmm. Angel. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. The X-Files. I remember the end of the X-Files. It wasn't very good is why I remember it. what else do I remember the end of?
I have some of mine, which are like a completely mixed bag. The Sopranos, I remember, of course. I remember the end of The Hills vividly. I remember the end of Battlestar Galactica, which is,
oh,
I guess,
yeah.
My Lost.
I remember the end of that. That was
more,
bad.
Yeah, with All Along the Watchtower.
I actually, at some point, we should talk about this, but I actually have a theory for rewriting the final 2 episodes of Battlestar so that it is not terrible.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I would love it so much. I do actually think that show was so, so good up until the end, like the very last episode. It wasn't like, oh, it's like lost its way. I don't know what's going to happen. It was like, no, this is great. I can't wait to find out what happens at the end. And then, like, it all kind of, the wheels start to come off in the last meter.
Yeah.
It was a little rough.
I'm sorry, Starbuck. Sorry about how that finale
so, yeah,
treated
seriously.
You deserved better.
I think that Those are my main shows that I really like assign a lot of meaning to the ending.
Yeah, I get a little hamstrung by this actually because I have a hard time watching TV shows all the way to the end.
Like
for The Sopranos, for instance, I think I watched like 2 seasons. I enjoyed the 2 seasons and then I stopped. You know what I mean? Like this is a thing for me is that I'll have a couple.
But season 3 is the best.
Okay.
No, I'm gonna rewatch Sopranos soon. That's an upcoming project of mine because I still list it as one of my favorite TV shows, but I haven't actually watched it since it was on. So,
but you know, I mean, that's not the only way to do an ending, right? Like sometimes you get the ending right at the very beginning. Like I'm thinking, or you know what's going to be happening. Like Citizen Kane opens with Citizen Kane dying. Right? Like, that's the beginning.
Yeah.
And, like, the mystery is what do his dying words mean?
Right, yeah. And, I mean, my favorite... I mean, I think you see this happening much, much more in movies, obviously, or in books. I'm trying to think of a TV show where you found out the ending at the beginning.
That happens sometimes in the episode, but not usually over the course of...
Yeah.
Or, like, sometimes over the course of the series, but not usually over the course of, like, several seasons.
Watch, I bet like somebody's gonna tell us that that's like Suits is like they already spoiled the end where like everybody lives inside a snow globe or something. It would always be Suits. I think it happens much more in like single volume type experiences. But there's also stuff like Titanic where you know it's going to happen because it's called Titanic. And obviously the ship is going to sink. That's definitely like, you know how many people are going to die on the ship. But the joy of watching it for 3 hours is the powerful love story and the discussion of class and the turn of the century.
Also the naked drawing.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, these kinds of narratives sort of prop up something that we've talked about earlier, which is, you know, that spoilers actually don't necessarily take away from your experience of a well-crafted narrative. And that sometimes like knowing what the ending is going to be lets you experience everything as anticipation for the ending.
Yeah. And actually, this is perfect because Don't Breathe is like that too. Don't Breathe has like a flash of the ending. And you know that at some point the character is going to be in that situation that she's in. And you kind of keep wondering how on earth that's going to happen because it seems kind of implausible. But and I like that. I like that, like, okay, what's going to, like, trying to piece it together in your mind of, like, what has to happen for the point that I'm at right now to connect with the point that I've seen. And it keeps you engaged in a way. But, you know, we're very clearly on the pro-spoiler side of things. I mean, I just had Cabin in the Woods spoiled for me after years of avoiding it. So, obviously, I'm okay with it. What would be something right now that's currently running, I guess a TV show or a film series or something where you think like it could be ruined by an ending at this point? Like, could Game of Thrones be ruined if it had a bad ending right now?
Maybe. if we've gone through this whole thing and it turns out that like we get some extremely pat and unsatisfying ending, I think people will be up in arms because that show has sort of made its bones like by killing off the guy who was supposed to be the protagonist in the very first season, right? Like the season ends with the guy who's been explicitly set up as your hero being beheaded in front of his children. And at that point, all the rules go out the window, as you understand them for this kind of genre. And so to me, like if you have some overly pat ending that provides too much closure or doesn't feel sufficiently ambiguous or messy, I think that that's the kind of thing that could wind up undermining everything that came before it.
But that... See, that's the thing that goes back to the narrative psychology aspect of it, where, you know, we were just talking about Battlestar Galactica, and I maintain that I had a blast watching that show. Like, I still recommend that show to people because I think the whole process of watching all of those episodes is really engrossing and interesting and unpredictable and satisfying.
It's one of the best shows about politics I've ever seen.
Oh, totally.
It's like far more realist than The West Wing in that particular respect.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, I think all of the what ifs that it asks in its first couple seasons pay off. Like, they go further down the trail of each of those questions than I think most other shows have the wherewithal to do. And, you know, even knowing that the ending is bad and telling people, yeah, I don't like the ending so much. Like, I feel like I can still say that I enjoyed the journey on that. And I can say, like, I enjoy, like, on fluffier fare, too. Like, I don't know. Like the OC or something. I enjoyed watching the OC and then it got not so great and I stopped watching it and I don't hold it against it. I'm like, they did a really good job for a couple of years there.
I watched two seasons of that. This is like a recurring theme.
Same. I think that's a perfectly fine amount of seasons of OC to watch.
But I mean, this is not a problem that's just like limited to TV, really. Because I mean, it's a well-known problem. Like Huck Finn has a famously bad ending. Okay.
What happens at the end of Huck Finn? Because I never read it.
Oh, okay. Well, it's you know, there's this whole thing where like Huck builds a friendship with Jim, who's an escaped slave, and that's like you know.
Oh, I saw the movie starring Elijah Wood, but I'm pretty sure it was very Disney-fied.
And then he just kind of turns around and forgets all of this relationship that's built and like falls back really easily into his old habits as soon as Tom Sawyer arrives. And like it's all of this like development that's happened of this character is immediately, you know, gone, and like all of this affection that you notice in the way that, you know, Jim and Huck's relationship builds, like, just, you know, Jim might be dead when he gets lost in the fog at the end, and Huck just doesn't care. And he doesn't seem that excited when, like, Jim's alive after all. And then, you know, it's just, it's like there are these things where you're like, oh. So, you know, at the end, when Jim's under Tom's sway again, he kind of felt pity for Jim. He had this, like, bond. And then now he's capable of making Jim's capture, because, again, he's a runaway slave, the occasion for a game.
Yeah.
That's what happens. And it's an unsatisfying ending, even though that is often how people behave. You know, they grow and then they just forget that they have grown.
Well, maybe, I mean, sounds like a real 70s downer ending right there. Did Mark Twain originate the 70s downer ending?
I think you could make an argument for that.
I think in general, though, any series of books, like, I feel like, especially recently with big YA franchises, that sort of thing, the last volume tends to be the one that people like the least. I think especially these more recent YA books like Hunger Games or Twilight or something, they tend to get so wrapped up in themselves and like self-mythologizing that it's really hard for them to dig their way out. I haven't read the last Twilight book, but I saw the movie. But I did read the last Hunger Games book, and it took me a year, like in spurts, going through it because it was so boring. I think when you're doing anything where you have periods in between where you get feedback, so like doing a series of books or making a TV show, I think the more you have that outside feedback, the harder it is to dig yourself out and like stay on message or not be swayed by outside opinion.
Yeah, I mean, you can even see people like often course correcting for the better in response to the audience, right? Like, so in Buffy, for instance, like Spike was meant to be a throwaway character, and the accident that was originally written to kill him in fact just cripples him and we get him for several more seasons. Or like, is it Family Matters that has Urkel? Urkel was like a walk-on character. And he was so enormously popular with the audiences that he became like the protagonist of the show after the first season.
Yeah, that also happened with Jesse on Breaking Bad. Some would say that was maybe he should have just stayed a walk-on. I don't know. Well, we're talking about endings today because this is the last episode of Verge ESP. We are calling it quits after this week's episode,
Which is why we thought we would talk about endings, not only because
and final girls,
yeah, because that's us, we're the final girls, but also because it seemed like a satisfying way to think about narrative form, which is something that we've been doing pretty much since the beginning, I think. And thinking about how, you know, what we know of human psychology impacts storytelling.
Yeah.
And so it felt thematically appropriate to make our final show be about finales.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that that's been what we've wanted to do, is kind of talk about how, especially once you get into the realm of neuroscience, how much science impacts the way that we experience entertainment and experience stories. And so we hope that everybody has enjoyed experiencing our story with us for your GSP. I've had a lot of fun having these conversations with you every week, Liz, and I hope to continue to do that in a non-podcast form and selfishly.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've certainly enjoyed this a lot, because I never know what I should be watching or paying attention to, and I feel like I have just gotten a crash course on how to think about critically, how to think about particularly movies and the way that movies deal with narrative and character.
Well, you should not rely on me for what you should be watching at any point in time, but I'm happy to help you figure out what to think about things. And we'd also like to thank Andrew Marino, our brilliant producer, who's been putting these episodes together, and I think been doing amazing things with them.
Yeah, he's the wind beneath our wings, really.
And takes all our song requests. So thank you, Andrew. So that is it for us. Thank you for listening, especially those of you who've been with us from the beginning. We really appreciate your feedback. And yeah. That's Verge ESP signing off.
Thanks, friends. And in